If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello and welcome to Caged In Presents Coppola Connections, as ever brought to you by the Breadcrumbs Collective and hosted by me, Petros Patsilivas. This is episode 52 and the film on the docket this week is I Heart Huckabees, but more on that later. If this is your first time listening to this here podcast, what we do here is we watch every single film in the collective Coppola family filmography to determine, are they the greatest film family of all time? I do not do that alone. Each week I'm joined by a guest, and this week is a fantastic one, as they always are. We talk about this film kind of around this film. It's a very hard one to talk about. If you've ever seen I Heart Huckabees, you very much know what I'm talking about. It's a bizarre one to try and make any heads or tail of. So we do our best. There are spoilers as there ever is. So if you have not seen this film, head on over to Disney Plus right now at your peril, should I say. So yeah, enjoy my conversation with Alex Cronenberg. This is a really fun one and it's kind of interesting. You'll get into it. We kind of work out how we feel about this film as we go on. We inevitably talk about the kind of controversy and scandal around this film and on-set behavior of David O. Russell. And yeah, as I've said in this intro already, we kind of try our best to talk about this film without kind of talking about this film. So let's have an existential crisis, try and save some trees and do some weird shit as we make some Coppola connections. Is life filled with coincidences and connections, or is it all meaningless? Well, one thing I do know for sure is that this week's film is David O. Russell's 2004 black comedy, I Heart Huckabees. Written and directed by David O. Russell, co-written by Jeff Boehner. And the film stars Jude Law, Lily Tomlin, Isabelle Huppert, Dustin Hoffman, Naomi Watts, Mark Wahlberg, and today's Coppola Connections, we get two for the price of one with Jason Schwartzman and his very own mother, Talia Shire. To help me figure out what it's all about, connectivity, meaningless, and most importantly, are the Coppola family the greatest film family of all time? It's film journalist and writer Alex Cronenberg. How are you today, Alex?
I'm excellent. It's so good to be here. I'm excited to talk about this unusual specimen. should be a good one.
Yeah, I put this out online recently to see what I put out a list of films that were coming up on the podcast, and this one seemed to be much of a talking point and kind of quite divisive in what people thought about it. A friend of the podcast, Paul Wilson Morris, said, I couldn't get through 20 minutes of this film. Like, I hated it. So, and then one person was like, well, that's one of my favorite films of all time. So it's going to be interesting to see where we both fall on it. I'm going to keep my cards close to my chest and kind of maybe try and dissect how I feel about this film as we go on, if that's all right with you.
You'd be relieved to know I did get through 20 minutes of it, so that should make decent pod, at least.
Yeah, this was before I watched this was a first time watch for me, and it was the first, like, before I'd watched the film, and I was like, oh no, I don't want this in my head going into a film. I never want, like, someone, I couldn't get through the first 20 minutes. I was like, well, I have to get through the entire hour and 54 minute running time or whatever it is. So as we always do on this podcast, Alex, the first question we like to go to is, when did you become aware of the Coppola family? So what was your entry point, and when did you realize this kind of this sprawling cacophony of family members that make up this wonderful orchestra that is the Coppola family?
Well, you'd be shocked to know that I'm an absolutely massive fan of Nicolas Cage.
No.
Like yourself. huge fan. Since a very young age, I think the first film I watched of him was like Honeymoon in Vegas. I think my dad showed it to me on like a random Sunday afternoon.
Amazing.
Yeah, nice father-son bonding session over multiple Elvises.
PG indecent proposal, as I like to call it.
That's exactly right. I never thought of it that way. And so I've always like loved him and kind of like sought out anything he did. But people used to kind of tell me that he was a Coppola, and I never really knew what that meant at a young age. So it's like, I'm talking like 9 or 10.
He's a couple of what? He's a couple of what? He's a couple of kids and a coat? Like, what is he a couple of? Like,
and so like, yeah, I didn't really get what really that meant and the significance of that for a long, long time. I just knew that I loved him, and then started to use that trivia as well. Even though I was like, what does that mean? So I started telling people, and they're like, very good. Even though they probably didn't know what it meant either. Kids in the playground, just like, right, okay. He's one of them. So definitely Nicolas Cage was my start on point. And eventually, obviously, I did kind of like figure out what that entailed, and the kind of like dynasty that he came from. So it was a slow learning process, but it was through that legendary icon.
What were like when obviously you got of an age where you could kind of like, I don't know, process it and obviously know what a Coppola meant. Like, I don't know, was your mind blown, or were you kind of like, wow, this is like, did your feelings change on Cage at all as well? Like, I don't know, I guess now it's, everyone goes on about nepotism babies and stuff like that, but he seems like an interesting case.
Yeah, it was always based around Nick Cage. So I think it just kind of made me appreciate him more, that he didn't want to play on the fact that he was a Coppola, and that he wanted to make his own way in that world, where I think it would have been so easy to play on the fact that he was part of that family, and rather he'd pave his own way and did it through offbeat performances, taking risks, kind of exploring the boundaries of the art, rather than being...
Yeah, but let's be honest as well. He does appear in a couple of his uncle's films in the 80s as well. So he was happy to like kind of jump on there. I don't besmirch him for that. If my uncle was Francis Ford Coppola, I'd be like, oh, no, there with the begging bowl, like, please, Francis.
Yeah, that's true, I suppose. But I guess with general audiences, they'll see the name and they won't really know. So I think he was... He kind of that made me appreciate him more, even more. But then as you explore more and you became more involved with film, and I think even when I was talking to you and you were kind of like outlining some of the kind of other members of the family, that's when I really realized, God, this is, they really do have so many fingers and so many pies, like they're everywhere throughout Hollywood, throughout time. And I think it's only when you see the breadth of that, that you really appreciate that actually these people are such a force, and we wouldn't really have the industry, the artistry, and the cinema that we have today if it wasn't for them. So I think it does kind of blow the mind, and you kind of wonder, like, how has this happened? Like, how has this happened? And it must be more than nepotism. There must be other things at play. I think he's obviously a force, isn't he? Francis. So I think he's got a lot to a lot to be answered for already.
Well, I think there's an aspect as well that so many of them have carved out such a unique niche in what they do. Like obviously Francis, for many people, like kind of reinvented Hollywood filmmaking with The Godfather, and like Nicolas Cage has kind of, I don't know, created his own like nouveau shamanic like acting style and is kind of like a genre all to himself. And then like we look at Jason Schwartzman, it's like, do you know what I mean? He's kind of the king of these kind of offbeat comedies like throughout his career, and seems to be like a go-to guy for Wes Anderson and stuff like that. And it's kind of like, yeah, it's just fascinating that, that it's not just the fact that they're, I don't know, yeah, that they all seem different as well. And it's not like this kind of, I don't know, like the Baldwins. It's like, well, we're all trying to be like thriller, do you know what I mean? We're all trying to be like drama guys or something like that. It's like, I don't know, it'd be like one Baldwin being like, oh, I'm going to be the comedy guy. This one's I'm going to be that. It's like, or I'm going to be behind the camera. It's like they're all mainlining for the same thing. Whereas the Coppolas are like, we're just going to dominate all of it, right? Like Jason Schwartzman, like, I'll do some TV every now and then. I'll dip in here and there. Like Cage is like, I've got whatever I'm doing covered. Sophia's like, I've got whatever I'm doing, like absolutely like nailed. Yeah, it's always, I don't know, week in, week out, it kind of just, even though I don't know, have these conversations about, my mind is still blown that they exist at all.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, I think that I was looking at films, like, looking into connections today between them. And I was like, well, that definitely seems like a Francis production. Or that one looks like a Sophia production. That one might be something that I could see Andrew Schwartzman in. And I'm basically covering Hollywood and Hollywood films for the past, like, 60 years or 50 years or something like that. And you're like, this is ridiculous. Like, how am I doing this? And, you know, the only ones that I couldn't see anything in is like Sonic the Hedgehog 1 and 2 or something. But the rest of them, you know, they got them covered pretty much.
Yeah, it's like, I found it really funny because like there's obviously no announcement whether Nicolas Cage will be in, his character will be reprised in the next Into the Spider-Verse or Across the Spider-Verse movie. And then like casting announcement came out that Jason Schwartzman's going to play the villain. It's like, well, even if Cage is not in it, I still get to cover it on this podcast because there's so many Coppolas. Of course, someone's involved.
It works well for you. You know, you've got it covered.
Yeah. I'm going to be podcasting until I'm old and more grey than I already am. So let me ask you, Alex, have you ever had the pleasure of meeting a Coppola at all?
No. You are the closest I have come to meeting a Coppola. I think Petros, simply because of your love and admiration.
Yeah, I feel like at this point I'm an honorary Coppola. None of them probably know. One of them I know that knows me by name. That is it. But like apart from that, I feel I'd be welcomed at a Christmas party. I don't know. I'd like to think so. Anyway, I wouldn't nerd out too much. I'd hope.
I think that's enough. I think you should just covertly add your face to the family tree. And I don't think many people would question it, really. I think you know enough. I think you could replicate their style. You know, I think you're in.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe Gia Coppola's on the hunt for her husband. I could marry in. I could be, and then my career in film will blossom from just being married into the family, as it seems to do for many of the other people who marry into the family.
So true.
So when would you have became aware of Jason Schwartzman and Talia Shire, I guess? Like, but let's start with Jason Schwartzman. What would have been the first film you would have seen him in?
It would have been Rushmore. I think for many, many people, I think Rushmore was my entry point for Jason Schwartzman and my favourite Wes Anderson film, actually. Although he seems like he's been around for a long time. I think when I was watching the film we're going to talk about today, I.R. Huckabees, they refer to him as a young man in it. And like, I think at one point they say that he's 21. And I was like, no, that can't be right. I've been watching this guy for about 30 years. Like, that can't be right. He's not that young. And so Yeah, it seems like he's been around for a long time, but Rushmore was definitely my entry point. Yeah. That performance in that is so educated and mature and nuanced, and you feel lots of different kind of emotions for that character that you wouldn't expect for somebody who's been in the industry for as like short amount of time that he had.
Yes, first film, right? Like kind of...
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. It's his first film, and it's like there's something in his bones to just do that.
All those scenes, and you know, I also love the kind of Apocalypse Now homage in that film, which kind of keeps it in the family, which is amazing.
Yeah.
But yeah, definitely that. And then I also had a bit of an infatuation with, I don't know if you've ever seen, you probably have, there's a short before one of Wes Anderson's films. I think it's before Darjeeling Limited.
Yes, the Hotel Chevrolet.
That's right, Hotel Chevrolet, yeah. And I absolutely fell in love with that short, and I would like watch it like once a week, and I fell in love with Natalie Portman for a while because of it.
Who hasn't?
Yeah, he was just incredibly cool in that. And, you know, I don't think I'd seen a person who was kind of like this scrawny, kind of dweeby, very, very hairy guy, but he's just so overwhelmingly cool in that short, yeah. And everything that I wanted to be. And it was a little bit emo, and I think I was a little bit emo at the time. So I just loved it. So definitely those two are big focal points for me. And you know, that's where I point to when I say, well, where did you first hear of him?
That's they're two great entry points. And yeah, and highlight obviously his kind of ongoing relationship with Wes Anderson. Is like, it seems to be like, I will be covering all but one Wes Anderson film on this podcast, because, or two, yeah, we'll be covering Bottle Rocket or The Royal Tenenbaums, because they're the only ones that don't have a Coppola in, but the rest is packed to the gills, either in front of or behind the camera. So what about Talia Shire? When did you become...
Yeah, that's mad.
When did you become aware of Talia?
I think it probably would have been The Godfather. Mm-hmm. Again, though, not necessarily that I would have known who it was. But yeah, certainly The Godfather was one of the earlier times that I would have seen her and been affected by her performance. But she's one of those that kind of goes under the radar. A lot of the time, I think in The Godfather, she put in an amazing performance, but one that's probably overshadowed by a lot of the other incredible performances in that film.
100%.
And yeah, you know, she's one of those, actually, she's kind of like fantastic setting. Like whatever she does it wonderfully, but she's not necessarily the person at the forefront of the film that, yes, you're going out of it remembering, thinking that person was incredible. So maybe that's unfair to say, but certainly in my eyes, when watching The Godfather, I thought she was part of that incredible mise-en-scene, but not, yeah, the thing that I was dragging my attention.
What's fascinating about her as well is, as the films progress, like with The Godfather trilogy, like I think she's one of the best things about part three. I think like the stuff that she does is great. Like I think like her kind of almost filling in where, like, you can imagine, you can see where, like, the Robert Duvall stuff kind of, like, when he didn't come back for it, like, kind of got split up, and kind of they needed somebody for Pacino to bounce off with certain things who was still a part of the family. And she gets to kind of be there, like, as a big decision maker, and, like, it's got all that stuff with Vincent and stuff like that. So, yeah, I think them, and I think the Rocky films, she's great at kind of like, I don't know, like, yeah, throughout these series, like her characters, the progression. It's nice to see that she's got these two like franchises under her belt, and you get to, she's very much a wallflower in like the first Rocky film, and then by like three, she's giving like a rousing speech on the beach to Rocky to like amp him up, and it's like, yeah, this is what we want. This is what, like my girl Talia gets to shine.
She's very much a person that is fine to kind of allow people to react off her.
Uh-huh.
But in actuality, I do think she has got so much presence, and she does bring a lot to those Rocky films. I think in other actors' shoes, it could be a very throwaway character, but she adds so much heart. And I think I can see it. I can still see her face in that pet shop. I'm like, just like my heart breaking a little bit for her. And I don't think that couple, that romance is as sweet without her. So yeah, she is excellent. And it's a shame she's not in more, probably.
Yes. Yeah. It's a delight when she does turn up. I'll say that for sure. So let's move on to the main event, as it were, of our discussion. Let's discuss I Heart Huckabees. But before we do so, let's have a listen to the trailer.
Have you ever transcended space and time?
Time, not space. No, I don't know what you're talking about.
No.
Very, very good!
Robert, what brought you to the philosophical club?
You mean the existential detectives?
What kind of investigation?
Existential.
You'll spy?
Yes.
On me?
Yes.
Will you be spying on me in the bathroom?
Yes.
What are you doing here, Brad?
What?
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 Brad, you're killing me!
Shut up!
Everything is connected and everything matters. Now, isn't that cool?
Human drama is inevitable. Suffering cannot be diminished.
How am I not myself?
How am I not myself?
Myself.
You don't plant no tree in the parking lot!
How's the sex?
How's the sex?
We're private about our 7 minutes of heaven.
That,
8 minutes of heaven. It's not quality, it's quantity.
Jesus is never mad at us if we live with him in our hearts.
I hate to break it to you, but he is. He most definitely is.
There's glass between us. You can't deal with my infinite nature, can you?
That is so not true.
Wait, what does that even mean?
Say this blanket represents all the matter and energy in the universe, okay? This is me, this is you, and over here, this is the Eiffel Tower, right? It's Paris.
Everything is the same, even if it's different.
Exactly, because we are connected. While we're putting in this mess,
is anybody's guess? Might be a test, or it might not be anything you need to worry about.
Now.
But if you're still
very, very good.
In doubt, go knock yourself out.
So the film premiered at TIFF on September 10th, 2004. And hit general release on October 1st of the same year. It's made on a budget of $20 million and had a box office return of $20.1 million. So I'd imagine with marketing and all the other costs that go into it, this was considered a flop at the time, I'd imagine. And we'll get into why that possibly could be as we go on through this conversation. But before we do so, Alex, could you have the absolute terrible pleasure of telling us what I Heart Huckabees is all about?
I'll try. I was watching some research before today, and they asked Dustin Hoffman the same question, and he didn't do very well. So I'll give it a go. Okay, so Albert Markovsky, played by Jason Schwartzman, is an existential turmoil. He hires a pair of detectives that specialize in guiding people towards inner peace. Unfortunately for Albert, the detectives fail to put his mind at ease, and instead he spirals out of control and into the arms of nihilistic author and life guru Catherine, played by Isabel Huppert. What follows is a quirky journey of self-discovery for Albert, his friends, and also his worst enemies. That's what I've got.
That is perfect. That is what we want. That is what this film is in a nutshell. And it's so much more, and it's very complex. So before I talk about my experience with this film, what is your relationship to it? When did you first see this film? Like, did you catch it back in 2004?
Not long after, actually. I think my sister was really into like her films early on. She's probably one of my kind of like guiding lights during that time. Nice. And earlier on, so she'd come home with lots of like cool rentals and like Evil Dead and stuff like that. And she introduced me to some of the best, whilst I was renting, you know, Road Trip or whatever. So then we'd swap and I'd watch the good stuff. And so I watched this back probably, it would have been like 2005, probably not long after it was released on rental. So I did see it not long after release. And I remember, I haven't watched it since, but I remember at the time really enjoying it and having a really good time with it. I don't think I understood it, but I enjoyed the performances and the elements of comedy. I think I kind of got a lot out of that. And I was really into stuff like early Wes Anderson, stuff like Garden State and those kind of indie dark comedies.
Yes.
And this kind of fell into that bracket, but actually now I revisit it, I don't think it does at all. So I did see it around that time, and then it was interesting to revisit actually.
I remember around the time, and I'd never, like, one of them I still haven't seen, but I remember getting confused with this, and like my perception of what this film was, like, because I didn't read anything about it, like kind of going in before watching it, what the kind of plot was. I thought it was a kind of like family comedy drama, in almost like in the way of like the Royal Tenenbaums. I thought the Huckabees were a family. And like, I thought it was going to be that, like the interplay between this kind of dysfunctional family, because it kind of felt like for me in some way that, I don't know, David O. Russell and Wes Anderson were kind of like in this weird competition, like both looking back to filmmakers that they adored, like with Russell's earlier films, like Flirting with Disaster, which I covered on this podcast. Like he's like, oh, I want to make like a screwball comedy. And it's like, do you know what I mean? Is this looking back, and he's like, Sin, the Royal Tenenbaums, just like, oh, I can do something better. It's not that entirely. It's a far weirder thing. I'm gonna be honest with you, like I had to watch this film in two sittings because it like kind of split my head a bit, and I guess it is the thing that I went into this film as a 31-year-old man, as opposed to maybe being like an impression. I don't know, maybe if I'd met it at the time that it came out, even though what, I would have been 14, like I probably would have got more out of it, like possibly because I would have been at that time like very like, oh yeah, what is life? Like, does it have meaning? Is it all nothingness? Is it all meaningless? Like, whereas like, I don't know, I think now I'm probably... I developed my own philosophies on life and kind of what it all means, and kind of quite set in what I feel about things. I don't know, maybe it's cynical, maybe it's kind of realist. I don't know, maybe I don't have the impressionable mind that this film really hits you. But back to my original point as well. I used to get confused with this film and Risk Cutters for some reason. I think that was the point I was trying. I don't know why. I think that feels like another kind of navel-gazy, like dark comedy as well, from what I remember. And all I remember is Shannon Sossaman's in it, and I had a big crush on it when I was younger. Still kind of do. So how did you feel about the film on revisit? Like, had you kind of kept those warm feelings, or have they kind of faded since?
I really don't know. And maybe this isn't the best answer for a podcast, but I still don't know. I do like elements of it, and I kind of appreciate what he's trying to do. I can't help but feel it's pretentious. Mm-hmm. But then I feel like, well, look at that cast. They can't all be fooled. So it must be good. And then I watch it, and there are parts which I find really funny. But then... yeah, I'm really torn. I don't know how I feel about this film at all. I don't know whether I like it. I don't know whether I hate it. I don't I really need to make a decision, I think, at some point.
I think this discussion is us figuring it out.
Of it that he does really, really well. Yeah, exactly. That's what we need. That's what this podcast is for me today. Just some therapy so I can figure things out and make my mind up. I think the stuff around it definitely makes me like it less. Mm-hmm. When I read around it and the research and stuff, it makes me like it less. But then if I took it for what it was, I'd probably enjoy it more. And I think that's what I did as a kid, where I just watched it and I kind of enjoyed the comedy and didn't really think about too much about all the points that he was trying to make. And I think that's the problem with it, actually, is that he's throwing too much at it. He's throwing everything at the screen. Well, yeah. Everything. And I watched an interview from him. And he kind of said that that he was inspired by J.D. Salinger. Then he was inspired by this Zen master who ran this meditation class that he used to go to. And then one of his lecturers. And I was like, well, this is too much. Like, he's just literally just throwing everything that he's experienced in the past 10 years at a screen. And he's given too much freedom. And then what he's got is just a bit of a mess, I think.
Yeah, I'm not sure how you felt about it, but for me, it very much felt like I kind of had to double check. I was like, is this a Charlie Kaufman script? It kind of feels like a half-baked, like, do you know what I mean? Like, early Charlie Kaufman thing. I'm not sure if you've ever seen the film Human Nature. Stars Reese Ifans, Tim Robbins, and Patricia Arquette. It feels similar to that in like this kind of, I don't know, it's just got a very weird tone to it, which like feels like a massive departure from what David O. Russell had done previously. I guess like up until this point, like you really couldn't pinpoint what kind of filmmaker he was, because yeah, what, 1999 he had made Three Kings, which is totally different to this movie entirely.
Oh yeah, it's miles away from him, but I think that gives him carte blanche, Three Kings. I mean, people like that a lot. I'm not sure off the top of my head, like at the box office, how well it did. But he's certainly given a lot more power, and I think actors wanted to work with him, and then that gave him even more power. But unfortunately, he doesn't really know what to do with them. I've never seen Naomi Watts in a role like this, where she is completely kind of like wasted. I mean, for the first, I don't know, hour and a half of the film, she's literally just in like a bikini dancing around, and that's it. And it's all very leery as well. It's not, it feels a bit uncomfortable watching her perform. And then he does the same with Isla Fisher as well. And yet it just feels a bit uncomfortable and odd, and I'm not too sure why this is happening and why I'm watching it and why is she involved. She's an incredible actor. Mm-hmm. And so he's got all this power and all these actors to get on board, and then doesn't really know what he's going to do with it. And I think his ideas aren't thought through enough, and the script isn't succinct enough to then offer anything kind of like satisfying. So then you're just left with like an odd screwball comedy, which isn't as good as Wed Anderson, Noah Baumbach, but kind of wants to be there or thereabouts anyway.
Yeah, I guess those three guys are very much like of a kinship, right? They're kind of these guys who came out in like the early 90s, like the mid 90s, kind of. I don't know. This one, like for me, like you mentioning Three Kings, yeah, that was like a big critical and financial success. So that film, it grossed $60 million in the US and $100 million worldwide. Whereas, yeah, as we said, this one like didn't even wash its face. Do you know what I mean? It just barely made back its kind of budget, let alone, like, that's not even factoring in, like, you got to imagine there's probably, I don't know, half of the budget on marketing and stuff like that. And like, I imagine a lot of the budget went on this kind of talent. And I know that the talent as well, like Dustin Hoffman and Jude Law, found it really freeing, like David O. Russell's kind of way of working. Like it was very loose, and we'll get onto maybe at times it possibly felt like it was too loose for some people, and it was directionless. And I guess, yeah. Well, Danny, should we jump into that now, or should we hold off on the kind of drama that surrounds this film? It kind of feels like the elephant in the room, and it kind of feels like maybe we should pop that balloon now, right?
Yeah, let's get out of the way. I mean, that cast, I'm just looking through the names of that cast, Petros, and it's a joke. You've got Jude Law, Isabelle Huppert, Dustin Hoffman, Jason Shorten, Naomi Watts, Mark Wahlberg, Tippi Hedren, Jonah Hill, Richard Jenkins. And that cast is mad, isn't it? Like,
yeah.
When have you ever seen a cast like that before? Like, it's so bizarre. Weird. But there you go. And I haven't even mentioned the person who most of the furor is regarding, and those infamous YouTube videos are kind of based around.
The formidable Lily Tomlin. Let's listen to a clip of David O. Russell after Lily Tomlin has like a disagreement about his directing, right? He's kind of every minor thing he's trying to get her to change, and like not really giving her room to breathe. And this is David O. Russell's reaction.
Fuck you! I'm just trying to fucking help you. Do you understand me?
No,
I'm being a fucking collaborator. I'm just trying to help you figure out
your
fucking picture. Hey, bitch! I'm not here to be fucking yelled at. I worked on this fucking thing for 3 fucking years not to have some fucking cunt yell at me in front of the fucking crew when I'm trying to fucking help you, bitch! Figure it out yourself.
Well, I have to.
Yeah, fuck yourself! Why don't you fuck your whole movie? Because that's what you're doing. We better get some insurance against the director. You're a fucking grown-up. Act like a grown-up. You're not a baby. You're a fucking grown up. I'm here to fucking help you. That's all I was doing, was trying to help you figure out anything.
But
I can help.
Talk to me.
You want to yell? Do I not fucking yell at you before right now? No. I never fucking yelled at you. You fucking
standard. That's the yelling standard for the whole.
It's kind of. It's one of those clips. I'm not sure how you feel about it. Like, obviously, listening to the audio, right, is really like kind of harrowing to listen to. But like watching it. So one of those, it's like so awkward, like I can't help but laugh. And like, it's like, just because I need to break the tension with myself. And there's a moment in it, and I know it's horrific, but there is a moment in the clip where he storms off a set, and that's in the moment in the clip where it goes quite quiet. And he kind of bursts in through like a side door to continue the argument. And it's like, fucking hell. You always want to grab him and be like, David, get the fuck out of there. Like, he seems like guy, and I feel kind of safe to say this, and I think it's he's kind of, his combative and abusive like nature has kind of been outed a few times. I know that George Clooney, they nearly had a fist fight whilst making Three Kings. I think Amy Adams during American Hustle, like, reported things of kind of being berated, and kind of he wasn't very polite, and he actually physically assaulted Christopher Nolan at a Hollywood party as well. So like the guy seems like he's got anger within him.
Yeah, it's weird because like you listen to all the interviews with him, and he's all about Zen and Buddhism and meditation. You know, we're all part of this blanket. And then you watch a video like that, and like, where was that guy? Where's he gone? Like, this is not the same person. And it's very contradictory. That video is like you say, that when he stormed off stage, off the set, and then comes in through a set door and keeps on going. You're like, what are you? And Jason Schwartzman, through the whole of that time, it's quite poor quality, but I'm fairly certain it's him in the foreground. It's just like sat there, like kind of like shrinking in his chair, like desperate to just get away from the situation.
Yeah. And he eventually does leave.
It's really shocking. Right? And he kicks loads of stuff at one point.
Yeah.
Yeah, he does. Yeah, he eventually leaves and kind of exits. But yeah, really, really kind of like shocking. And then there's another video. I don't know if you saw it, but there's one where Lily's in the car.
Yes.
And she's basically talking to David. You can't hear what he's saying, but she's like, she's going off on one and ranting and you know, telling him to fuck off and go away and shouting at him and stuff. And I watched an interview with her from recently, and she kind of said, well, you can't hear what he's saying to me, and he's just being disgusting to me the whole time. Mm-hmm. And she openly says now that they're friends and they get on and that they, you know, there's no problem between us anymore. But I definitely don't think that that was like the sole incident on that set. I wouldn't want to work with him.
I think the timeline of that as well is the incident in the car was the day before the incident in the office. So it's like, it's bubbled up. Yeah. And that, like, Lily Tomlin in that car, like, there's a moment in that when I think Dustin Hoffman's trying to like calm her down, and she's like, you can fuck off too. Like, he's there kind of like being the, trying to be like, trying to ease the tension. She's like, you can fuck off too. Like, this is, and you really get her point as well. Cause I think like one of the, and Dustin Hoffman kind of like interjects as well. He's like, you've told us to like come down like half a step, but we have been filming all day, very broad, very comedically, very heightened. And now you're telling us to like not be that. And it's like, I imagine for them, it's very frustrating. It's like, well, where's the fucking continuity in the performances if all of a sudden you're telling us to be restrained from what they've been doing? And this film is far from restrained.
Well, I think that speaks a lot of how much he was confused about what he was trying to do here, because he has all these comedic scenes and stuff, but then he wants to talk about novels and philosophy and existentialism, and he wants to have all these grand ideas, but he can't balance it with comedy. And I think that's a real problem. So he doesn't know what he wants to do with the actors, and he doesn't know how he wants to present this script. Mm-hmm. And so he gets on top of him. He's obviously, I think she says at one point, it was a very pressured environment. And I think that's because he didn't know how to present the material that mm-hmm. he had. And I think probably it's credit to the actors that we get some of the excellent parts in this film that we get, because there are some really funny moments and some really great scenes that I put up there with some, you know, some of the great scenes in this kind of genre or this ilk. And that's because of the performances, but he's treading a fine line there. He's on the verge of being in a lot of trouble, I think. And people who, I know there's a lot of critics now who won't watch his films and don't want anything to do with him. So he is starting to become a toxic entity that really is maybe a symbol of an old Hollywood that doesn't really exist anymore. And he's probably not welcome in New Hollywood right now. And I wonder whether negative reviews of Amsterdam are a sign of those times, perhaps.
Well, yeah, there's like, and like, we haven't even mentioned those like allegations against David O. Russell for sexually assaulting his transgender niece. So like, there was a lot, I remember seeing a lot of kickback when like the cast announcements kept coming through for Amsterdam. It's like, why are all these people working with David O. Russell? Do you know what I mean? Like, not only is he like famously known for being very problematic to work with, like, do you know what I mean? Like, and it's not even like, he's, I don't know, not that you can just chalk it up to the folly of youth with I Heart Huckabees, but do you know what I mean? He's still pulling that shit in 2013. Do you know what I mean? As I said, he physically attacked Christopher Nolan. Like, I don't know. I sometimes think Christopher Nolan does deserve a slap, but I wouldn't actually act upon it or tell someone to do that. But like, yeah, it seems bizarre, right? And I think it is testament to this whole thing. Obviously, this isn't like the culture war podcast or anything like that, but it very much speaks to that whole thing that cancel culture doesn't exist. Do you know what I mean? And if anything, like, people just need to be held accountable for the way they act, and like, they, like, I don't know, basically half of Hollywood saying, hey, yeah, I'll do your mystery comedy thriller movie. It's kind of a bit like, really? Is this the message you want to send out to people? Like, you could be an arsehole to people and still, like, most of Hollywood will be in your movie.
It does worry me. It does make me think, well, do well. Whether at that point, that's when people say, oh, no, we don't want to work with David Russell anymore. And it's actually because the film didn't do very well, rather than his very obvious issues with working with people and his aggression and his anger towards his staff, his crew and his cast. I certainly felt a lot different about Al Huckabee's after watching these videos. You know, that he's so kind of complimentary of Dustin, as Dustin Hoffman and Lily Tomlin after the fact. But I do feel like, how can you sit there and look at him? Like, I wouldn't want to do any sort of press with him after that kind of performance.
Yeah, it's a kind of, it's difficult, isn't it? It's a real sticky thing. It's like, it's weird. I just find stuff like that weird. Like, obviously we're kind of living through similar stuff at the moment. Obviously we don't know the full ins and outs. I guess there's probably more stuff to come out in future. I think the video of Lily Tomlin didn't even come out until only like, not even, like 5 years ago or something. Was it 2017? Like, was when those videos from the I Heart Huckabee set kind of came out. And yeah, we're kind of going through a similar thing with like all the kind of furore around Don't Worry Darling. Do you know what I mean? Like, that's that kind of, who knows what happened on that set. That sounds like more of an interesting film than Don't Worry Darling.
You're so right. Yeah, I mean, I actually don't think that, you know, if you balance that and you weigh that up now, like the things that happen on I Heart Huckabees, I reckon you could write a book about it. Whereas, you know, Don't Worry Darling, I think, is probably going to do pretty well because of the controversy that's come out regarding Florence Pugh. And I think that, you know, you just got to say, well, bloody hell, like, Lily Tomlin could have not done any promo for that at all, and she would have been within her rights. We probably wouldn't be talking about it. Not like that anyway. So it does make you think, actually, well, maybe we are in a kind of more progressive place where we don't allow behavior like that. But I'm not too sure. I think it is very much subjective, and it's very much dependent on the person, the celebrity status of that person. So I don't know whether, I think David Russell will probably still get away with it now, but we'll probably find out in a year's time when, you know, maybe Jennifer Lawrence comes out and says something that's happened. I think there's already been rumors about Christian Bale having to defend one of his co-stars whilst filming Amsterdam. And I can't recall the full story, but I'm sure I read something recently about that.
Oh, bloody hell. He's at it again.
He's a nightmare. He's a nightmare. Don't get involved. Stay away.
Yeah. It feels weird now. I wanted to ask you, what are your general thoughts on David O. Russell's career? Because it's kind of like, I think it's a real hodgepodge of films, right? It's kind of, I think even till today, you can't really say like, oh, describe to me what a David O. Russell film is, can you?
No. You'd have a hard time. I think Three Kings is a million miles away from I Heart Huckabees, which is probably a million miles away from Silver Linings Playbook. I think probably Silver Linings Playbook and Joy are probably two of his more similar films, although I must admit I haven't seen Joy because it just sounded uninspiring. So I didn't get around to that. But yeah, I'm kind of a bit ambivalent towards his career. He's not a filmmaker that I gravitate towards, or one that I think he has a personal style, or thematically I'm not really that interested in the things that he has to say. Mm-hmm. So I don't really necessarily feel like they're go-to. I did, you know, I'm a fan of Three Kings. I think Three Kings is a really standout film.
And I like The Fighter. It's
really interesting. Mm-hmm. Yeah, The Fighter's a great film. Yeah. And Christian Bale's fantastic in that, actually. And maybe it says a lot about him that Mark Wahlberg is his muse.
Yeah. Another very angry guy, do you know what I mean? Like he's somebody who's got a very shady past, like convictions from like assaulting Chinese American people and stuff like that, and being like very racist in his early years and stuff like that. I guess, I don't know, maybe they met at like a anger management group or something like that, like kind of, I don't know, Dickheads Anonymous.
Yeah. But he obviously has a bit of a kindred spirit in Wahlberg, but not someone who I would definitely rush out to the cinema and go and see his films. But I think Three Kings is probably the one that I'll always point to and say, that's a fantastic film. That's got some really great imagery, some good performances, and has a lot to say. But the rest of them, kind of a little bit like Oscar fodder. Mm-hmm. I feel like Silver Linings Playbook was a bit Oscar-y, and Joy was kind of like, this feels like it was very much tailored towards that group of Oscar voters. And so I care less about that. But he seems to, I mean, maybe with Amsterdam, things will change a little bit, and we'll get something which is taking some more risks. But I seriously don't think that his films, well, nothing can justify his behavior, but his films certainly don't justify that amount of passion that he seems to put into his projects anyway. So that's kind of my stance on David Russell, I think.
So let's kind of whiplash and go, try and talk about the things that we enjoyed in this film. What are some of the aspects of this film that you enjoy? I'll let you go first, because I think my list is relatively quite short.
There are definitely parts of it that I do like. I'm not too sure about the overall style. I think the acting style is really unusual in this film. It like borders on improv. And sometimes you feel like they're just going to break character and like look at the screen and break the fourth wall and kind of laugh and joke about. It's really unusual to know what's going to happen next, which at times is quite compelling, actually. But yeah, there are two scenes that I really enjoy. I think the first scene is like the dinner scene, where Albert and Mark Wahlberg's character, Tommy, go and try and find the subject of Albert's coincidences. Mm-hmm. And they find him at this house, this kind of like middle-class suburban house. And they're invited to dinner with this family called the Hootons. And it's a really kind of, I found it like a really funny scene where they go for dinner and both Tommy and Albert start to argue with the rest of the family.
Yeah.
And it's a really chaotic scene where like dialogue's flying about and it's singing off each other, and there's some really funny lines as well. And actually Mark Wahlberg's very amusing, and it's got the fantastic Richard Jenkins in it, who's fantastic in every single thing that he does, and a very early Jonah Hill performance as well. And that scene is great because it's got Tommy and Richard Jenkins' character, Mr. Hooton, arguing about religion and how religion has failed. And then you've got Albert trying to figure out like this existential crisis whilst arguing with two teenagers about a video game they're playing or something. Mm-hmm. And it's just so bizarre, but like really cutting. And it's got, you know, that's one of the scenes where I think, you know what, you've balanced it really well. Your dialogue is to the point and succinct and funny, but also the scene moves and goes somewhere and actually adds to the narrative as well. So that is definitely one of my favorites. I don't know how you felt about that one.
I do like that scene. And I think that scene feels like it's from a different movie. And I think there is like, there is a kind of compelling story within this. And I think there's a couple of compelling stories, but I don't think they all mesh well together. Like, I think there is just this kind of, this story of a guy having an existential crisis and maybe having this like weird coincidence or just trying to figure out what it all means. But then it kind of gets bogged down with this whole like detect, do you know what I mean? It's too weird for its own sake. And I guess at times it feels like you're being lectured by like an A-level student. And it's a bit like, okay, you've read one book on philosophy, or you've read two. You've read two opposing views on philosophy, and you'll be like, oh, that's going to make a really great film, that is. And it's like, it's a bit like, fucking chill out a bit, mate. Like, my patience for this was very thin. Like, and I guess, like, there were moments I liked, and I was almost willing the film to be like, make it about this, make it about Albert and just like this kind of him having these problems. Like, don't give us all this weird stuff on top of it. Like, I like Lily Tomlin, I like Dustin Hoffman and stuff, but I just felt like, and Isabelle Huppert, like their whole stuff was almost pointless to me. It's like, it just felt weird for the sake of weird.
But then again, like, you get like scenes with Jude Law, and I actually think Jude Law is the best thing about this film. I think he's excellent. He's really despicable and nasty. There's that great scene towards the end, and I don't know if you watched this in the first sitting or the second sitting, but where he's kind of confronted by the detectives and they're telling him that he's like his brother, which he dislikes, and he tells the same stories again and again and again. And Brad denies this, and then they play him all the time. So he tells a story about how he tricked Shania Twain into liking mayonnaise. And his response is absolutely genius. And I'm no fan of Jude Law, but his response goes from like amusement and like thinking he's dead funny to like despair and then anger. And it's just wonderful to watch, and actually really, really hilarious as well. So that part, that scene in itself is like, again, you've nailed it. You know exactly what you're doing there. And Jude Law is fantastic in it. But unfortunately, they're very, very few and far between. I think there are moments where he realizes his idea and he realizes his tone, but then that doesn't happen at all, really, in the rest of the film.
Yeah, it's tonally kind of all over the place, right? Like, and I think that kind of drama on set, like, I don't know. I would like to kind of know for a lot of the cast what their experience were like. Do you know what I mean? Like, Jason Schwartzman, I think he's, Jason Schwartzman's always compelling in stuff he does. He kind of plays these, I don't know, he plays kind of little arseholes really well. And he is a bit of a little arsehole in this. Do you know what I mean? He's a flawed guy. He plays these flawed guys. And I've said it so many times on this podcast, I think the fact that he perpetually looks like a child lets us forgive him. As an audience, I'm not sure how you feel about that.
No, definitely. Yeah, I completely agree. He's got this kind of like wide-eyed innocence. It's almost like when you tell a child off. I don't know about this, when you tell your son off, but when I tell my son off sometimes and he looks at me and kind of like looks kind of bewildered about why am I saying this? And it's almost like that with him, where he's, no matter what he does, he just puts on that kind of like face and like, I don't really know what I've done wrong here. And then you're like, oh yeah, you're just like, you're so naive and you're so innocent and you haven't experienced life yet. And he plays that role really well. And he's the same in this, where he is very pretentious and idealistic. And but then when he realizes his wrongs, it's actually quite heartbreaking. And he conveys that emotion very, very, very well as this contrite child who doesn't quite understand the things that he's done and the way in which he's hurt people. And he's excellent with that. He's very good at that.
I think reading around this film, I find like some stuff really interesting. And I guess one of them is the fact that Dustin Hoffman's character is based upon Robert Thurman, Uma Thurman's dad, and his experiences of learning that he was a metaphysical philosopher and David O. Russell studied religion under him. And it's like, give us the like that story without the bullshit. Like that is an interesting film. Do you know what I mean? Like I can only imagine, like, I don't know, it being something like The Master or something like that. Like this guy studying under this metaphysical philosopher. Like, do you know what I mean? And like learning about stuff. Whereas like this film at times just felt like woo-woo bullshit. Like it was just kind of a bit like, really? Like as I said earlier, like it's like somebody's read a couple of books and it's like, what if you studied religion under this guy? It's like, makes it have a bit more meaning. Do you know what I mean? It's kind of like, either fully commit. I do think that's my problem with this film. It does obviously fully commit to what it's doing, but it's like, if you want to make a film about the complexities of religion and what we're all doing here, I guess, like, about the meaning of life, or kind of, are we here as meaningless beings, or is there interconnectivity? Are we kind of this group hive mind and we're all connected under this like weird subconscious connectivity? Do that film, like do that as a hard hitting drama or something. Do you know what I mean? Like, or just do this kind of extent, like existential crisis comedy about Jason Schwartzman's character, and get rid of like all the woo woo stuff. Do you know what I mean? All the kind of like chin scratching, like going in body bags and all this, like, I don't, and I guess a lot of this film as well is kind of really dated by the kind of effects and stuff like that. Like when we get the kind of daydreams, or the kind of like, you know, when he goes into the method and the sitting in the tree, or Dustin Hoffman talking about how we're all connected and we get those like squares up on the screen. It's all a bit like,
yeah,
this feels very early 2000s.
Yeah, again, you're throwing everything out of here. There was a quote somewhere that said he sat down and he wanted to make a film about people listening to conversations in a Chinese restaurant and then writing fortunes for them, wacky fortunes, and then putting them in cookies and delivering to them to the people. And I, well, that's exactly what you've done. You've just basically just like randomized a load of ideas and then put them in cookies and let them, these actors open them. And then they have no idea what to do with that idea. So I think that's more accurate than the other thing that you're saying about existentialism. And I love Robert Thurman and he was my idol and this Buddhist and stuff. Really, you've just randomized a load of highbrow ideas that you don't fully understand and tried to make a strange comedy out of it, and it doesn't work.
So what other before we kind of start to wrap this up, what other aspects of the film were we like, did you want to talk about? Obviously, I guess one of them that I wanted to mention is, what did you think of the scene that we get with Talia Shire in this? Obviously, she's one of our Coppola connections.
Yeah, I think much of the same, really. I think it's neither here nor there. I don't think it adds a huge amount. Part of those two scenes that I've mentioned, I really don't think that that scene knows what it's doing as well. It feels like a bit pasted on to me, anyway. I don't know, what did you think? How did she live up to your Coppola connection expectation?
I thought she did fine with what she had. She kind of like Liza Minnelli'd it up slightly. I kind of like enjoyed that aspect of it. And I guess in that scene, it's like, again, it's presented to us like it's massively important and like this is a big breakthrough for the character and like his, do you know what I mean? That is the crux of his, the way he looks at himself and the way he treats himself and others. But like, I don't know. It, like, all of the revelations in this film feel quite hollow and empty. Like the film itself, I think it is quite like, as we've said repeatedly, it's a lot of shit thrown at the wall. But at the end of the day, like, if you just throw in every ingredient in your pantry, like, that does not make a good dish. Do you know what I mean? Like, if you put all the sugar and all the confectionery into a cake, it's not going to taste nice. Like, it's going to be too sweet. It's going to be like, and I think that's what this film does. It's got too much weirdness, too much kind of philosophical musings that it kind of turns me off to it. It's like, there's a way to make this stuff palatable and enjoyable and fun. Like, I don't know, I think Charlie Kaufman, when he's firing on all cylinders, like, kind of nailed this. That's why for me this feels like kind of pale imitation of what Charlie Kaufman was doing, because he manages, like, you look at like Being John Malkovich, kind of gets to really talk about self and identity in a weird way, and like how we view the world through others, and like actually living through somebody else's eyes and what that can do to a person. And then like adaptation, like the kind of doubt of self and creativity. I think those two films kind of really nail what like this film aspires to do, but in like, they're very high-minded and high concept, but at the crux of it, they're really fun movies to watch. Do you know what I mean? Like, they're really inventive and interesting. Whereas all of this movie looks like behind the scenes footage. Do you know what I mean? Like, it looks like an unfunny, like a predominantly unfunny bloopers reel.
I feel like it's like when you see a fake film being made in a parody.
Yes.
And then you're like, and then people, you know, you see a fake poster and you see fake scenes and you're like, oh, you know, this is meant to be funny. This is meant to be like, oh, the ridiculousness of making a motion picture. And that's what it seems like to me. Like, not a real film. Yeah.
you've absolutely nailed it there. I think that is it. And yeah, but before we start to write, is that one thing I really want to highlight about this film that I really enjoy, and I'm a big fan of his work anyway, is John Bryan's score. I think, like, it's great. I love his stuff, and like, but like, he's kind of shown himself like that. And again, I think where it kind of like goes down to the Charlie Kaufmanisms, because what, he scored Synecdoche, New York, he scored Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, and he kind of like cornered the market of that like weirdo comedy. And like, yeah, I think the score to this is great. I particularly love, there's a track called Later Monday, which like is fantastic. Oh, yeah, I'll play a little snippet of it. But that's, I don't know, it's something about it. It's got like a jaunt and like a, and the film that should be scoring, I want to watch, like, as opposed to this movie.
Well, the score gets the tone more than the director. I mean, Claire, the score understands the script more than the director does. Is he the guy, did he do Twin Peaks?
No, that's Angelo Badalamenti, the absolute master.
God, of course, yeah. That just sounds so. That sounds so Twin Peaks to me. That score, then, yeah, Twin Peaksy. I think he understands the assignment more than David O. Russell. but I don't think there's really any other part, I think, which are worth that talk. You know, why is Shania Twain in this? Why is Shania Twain?
I know
this film so much.
I know how she's in it. She's in it because Jude Law personally wrote her a letter, which I find really fascinating. And there is some like, there is some interesting stories why certain people are in this. So Jonah Hill, Dustin Hoffman's kids, saw Jonah Hill, I think, performing stand-up comedy or just, yeah, like, yeah, so, yeah. And one night they said, you should meet my dad. You should meet our dad. And he was like, no, you should meet my dad. And then like he got invited round to their house for dinner and then realized, oh shit, it's Dustin Hoffman. And Dustin Hoffman was really impressed by him that he actually asked David O. Russell to put him in the movie. So like, that's pretty great. Right? Yeah, it's great. Like gave Jonah Hill his break. Like this is his first like on-screen credit, I think, in a movie. So like that's pretty cool. We don't get.
Oh really?
Yeah. Maybe in another world we don't get we don't get Jonah Hill if it isn't for this film. So maybe that's a saving grace we can take from this.
I'll take that. It did one good thing then. That's good.
Yeah, and it kept Jason Schwartzman and Talia Shire in work, although I assume they would have been okay without it.
Definitely.
So as we start to wind things down, one of the first things we do is we talk about any Coppola connections within this film. Is there anyone in front of or behind the camera who has worked with the Coppolas elsewhere? Did you manage to find any?
I did. I tried to find one linked to Shania Twain, but I couldn't. The only thing that I could find is that she mentions Brad Pitt in That Don't Impress Me Much, who stars in True Romance with Dennis Hopper, who's also in Apocalypse Now, but I don't think that counts. So I think Naomi Watts is in this film, and then she went on to star in a film called, which I don't think many people have seen, and I haven't seen, a film called The Secret Life of the Lonely Doll, which is directed by Gia Coppola.
Okay.
But I think it's only available on like Mubi, and that's about it. I think that it got a very limited release. So I think it's her and Jessica Lange, I think, in this film by Jay Coppola. But that's one of the kind of like only ones I've found apart from the obvious.
So I've got a few here. So another Naomi Watts one for you. Naomi Watts is in The Book of Henry, which John Schwartzman, Jason Schwartzman's brother, was the cinematographer. Dustin Hoffman is also in Meet the Fockers, which John Schwartzman was also the cinematographer. And he's in All the President's Men, which David Shire composed the score for. Lily Tomlin is also in Flirting with Disaster, which stars Patricia Arquette, and does the voice of Mama in The Ant Bully, which features the voice of Nicolas Cage. And is also Aunt May in Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse, which also features the voice of Nicolas Cage as Spider-Man Noir. Yeah, I've got a few more here. So Jude Law is also in the Grand Budapest Hotel, which features a cameo from Jason Schwartzman. Mark Wahlberg is also in Three Kings, which stars Spike Jonze in a small part in there, who was, yeah, at the time married to Sofia Coppola. Isla Fisher is in two episodes of Bored to Death, the HBO series, which starred Jason Schwartzman. Mm. Kevin Dunn, the kind of stalwart of kind of American movies and comedy, who plays Jude Law's like boss or like kind of lackey. Oh, yeah. He's in Snake Eyes and The Frozen Ground, which both star Nicolas Cage.
Oh, I love Snake Eyes.
The film cinematographer, Peter Deming, was the cinematographer on Lost Highway, which the David Lynch film, which Patricia Arquette was in at the time she was married to Nicolas Cage. And here's one I particularly like, because it's kind of somebody doing what they don't normally do. So John Bryan, the film's composer, is in Funny People, which Jason Schwartzman also appears in. He's actually in the movie. It's one of like one of two credits he's actually got.
Well, that is amazing. That is why you are the king of Coppola. Like, I don't know. I looked for about an hour and a half. But like, I think I was focusing too much on Shania Twain.
I think it's potentially because I've got like an encyclopedic memory of which films they've been in. So
nailed it there, Petros.
Amazing, amazing. So let's move on to the rating this film. And the way we do that here is, what would be the perfect wine pairing for this film? What are we going for today, Alex?
Something pretentious and quirky. I don't really know my wines, but maybe like something organic that's made from like lingonberries that are grown on an island solely inhabited by Puritan goats, or something like ridiculously random that makes no sense. I would say, I think there's a place by my house where I live in Liverpool which sells wine made from oranges, so I can't imagine that's good, but it's certainly an unusual mix, so I'll go for that. Yeah. Orange wine.
I think it's going to be something that like has like a label that looks appealing, and then like you take that first sip and you just want to spit it out. You're like, fucking hell, what is that? Oh, tastes like vinegar. I think that's very much what this film is like. So how much are we paying for this wine, Alex? Is this bottom shelf, middle shelf, or top shelf stuff?
Somebody's gave me this wine. Somebody that doesn't like me very much in a Secret Santa. So I'm not paying for this wine, I trust.
Well, yeah, you get it free with your Disney Plus subscription.
Certainly, yeah. And it doesn't quite make any sense.
Yeah. It's only because of a weird merger with Fox that this is even there in the first place. Amazing. So based on this film alone, Alex, are the Coppolas the greatest film family of all time?
No, they're not. No, I'm sorry, they're not.
Jason and Talia try. They really try, but David O. Russell has let them down. And
stop the podcast now. Give up. They are not the greatest film family of all time. I'm sorry.
Oh man. Well, it's been lovely. Been lovely doing this, guys. As Alex said, I've got to call it a day. So this is the final episode of the podcast. But before we wind things down forever, let me ask you a couple more questions, Alex. The first one being, and it's a cruel one. This is why I'm always happy I'm on this side of the of the asking of this question. Which Coppola family member would you keep? But in doing so, you get rid of the entire filmographies of the rest of the family.
You probably know the answer. It's Nicolas Cage. I choose him. He's done too much that has like directly affected me in so many ways. Like, it's made me feel good in the bad times. It's made me understand life's complexities a little more. He's in like one of my favorite films of all time, which is Moonstruck. And I don't think that I would want to write about a film and want to be involved and talk about a film as much as I do without him. So Nicolas Cage, even though, you know, I love Sofia Coppola, I love Francis Ford Coppola, I think he has just had too much of an impact on my life for me to eradicate him. So he's my guy.
Well, you're preaching to the choir, my friend. You're preaching to the choir. He's one of a kind. So let me ask you possibly the most important question on this podcast, and that is, what does Bill Murray say to Scarlett Johansson at the end of Lost in Translation?
I think that he might say, we're just normal men, just innocent men. No, serious answer. I don't know, and I don't want to know what he says. I think the ambiguity of that ending is what makes it special. I think you take from it what you want to take from it. It's whatever it is, whether it's a promise to return, a joke, like a proclamation of undying love, we won't know. But the point is, like, I don't want to know. Like, the moment, that perfect moment is frozen in time. Mm-hmm. And as soon as we begin to know what he says, then that makes it a reality. And sometimes the reality can be uncomfortable or unsatisfying, or, you know, we actually see what happens and we start to realize about, like, the implications of that. And we don't want that. All we want is that moment of complete contentment and just like peace. And I think you don't get that in life. And I mm-hmm. think that's why that moment is absolutely, it's just so, so special. And I think the moment we start to, like, you know, raise the volume levels or lip read or try and figure it out is the time that we, you know, we stop believing in that magic. So just enjoy it and just enjoy the knowledge of not knowing.
Yeah. And I guess life isn't kind of, it doesn't end on these punctuations of great lines and stuff like that. It kind of just, it's quiet moments between people kind of having connections, and they're the things I think we hold dearest to us. It's not these kind of, I don't know, big proclamations and zingy one-liners or something like that. And yeah, that's a beautiful way to put it. And it's kind of, that's why I love ambiguity and stuff. Do you know what I mean? Like, this is, especially in my films. Yeah, I think not knowing is possibly the best. I don't know. I'm going to have to answer this question at some point. But
yeah. I mean, she's an absolutely beautiful filmmaker, Sofia Coppola. And if she wanted you to know, you would know. And she doesn't. She wants you to be in that space and have a moment of mindfulness, mm-hmm. And not think beyond that moment, just enjoy it. And she's given you that as like a little gift. So why return it? Just enjoy.
That's lovely. That's a perfect place to end this conversation. But before we do, where can people find you? Like, what publications are you writing for? And where's the best, like, kind of way on socials to keep up to date with everything you're doing?
Yeah, so mainly on Twitter, at Cronin Words, and I am in the whole a horror writer. So I write a lot about the genre, and I write for Moving Pictures Film Club. I write for Bloody Disgusting, Horrified, lovehorror.co.uk, focusing on all things kind of like grim and macabre. I've got a piece coming out for Moving Pictures Film Club about self-coined polite dread horror, and a couple of guest spots on Ghouls, on the Ghouls podcast. So a little bit and bobs coming up for Halloween, covering some films for Frightfest Halloween as well. So lots of bits and bobs. Love the season. Halloween, it's coming up, and I am ready for it.
Lovely stuff. Well, Alex, thank you so much for coming and making some Copeland connections with me.
Thank you so much for having me on, Petros. It's been so much fun.
So there we have it. We have a no. They are not the greatest film family of all time. It feels like it's been a while since we've had that answer, but this is a very Marmite film. I've checked over Letterboxd and there's people who love it. There's people who don't love it. As I said in that intro, Liam H. Dempsey and Paul Wilson Morris of the Spotlight podcast both hated this film. Paul didn't even get past the first 20 minutes. If you've got past the first 20 minutes of this film and feel differently, or you agree with myself and Alex, please do get in touch. You can always get in touch with the podcast at Caged In Pod on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, Letterboxd, and TikTok. Or you can drop an email, which is cagedinpod@gmail.com. As much as I dislike this film, I would very much still like to have a conversation about it with people. Maybe people could sell it to me. Like, there are aspects of this, like some of the acting, some moments in this I did particularly enjoy. And as I said, I love that John Bryan score. I just think as a whole, it really does not hang together all that well. It kind of feels a bit woo-woo and a bit bullshit when it kind of get down to brass tacks. It kind of feels like once you put the microscope over it, it falls apart very, very, very quickly. So yeah, enough about I Heart Huckabees. What have we got coming up next week on the podcast? Well, our Coppola connection for next week is Jason Schwartzman's older brother, John Schwartzman. And the film we will be talking about is the Paul Feig 2018 comedy, drama, mystery, A Simple Favor. And my guest for that episode is a returning guest. Those of you who would have listened to my Con Air round table would have heard the fantastic Claire Ellen Hope of the amazing W-rated podcast. And yeah, we're going to be talking about that film. I haven't recorded it yet, but if I know Claire like I know Claire, it's going to be a real hoot to talk to her about a film that I know she is very, very passionate about. If you enjoyed this episode or have enjoyed any episode of the podcast, even vaguely, slightly, and would like to help out financially, you can do so over at patreon.com/cagedinpod. It's in a bit of a limbo state at the moment. I really need to pull my finger out, but I've just been adjusting to going back to work, doing loads of other stuff, and just kind of having a life. But yeah, that always helps. I know that times are very tough at the moment for people financially, so I totally understand it. If you don't want to part with any extra money, and that is absolutely fine, I will still be delivering episodes week in, week out, because it is something that I love doing. So if you want to not part with cash and still support the podcast, you can do so by heading over to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you're listening to this right now. And if they have any way of you leaving a rating and review, what would be fantastic is if you did that, especially on Apple Podcasts, if you let me know what you think that Bill Murray said to Scarlett Johansson, I'm going to start reading them out. Any of your reviews, I will read them out. I'll give you a shout out on the podcast because, it really does help. I know podcasts say this. I say this week in, week out, but it really does help to get more eyes and ears on the podcast. And I don't know, it's a real serotonin boost to make those charts and stuff like that. And I just have this kind of arbitrary goal of getting in the top 10, like to kind of see myself amongst podcasts that are massively successful, and also I am massively kind of in awe of because of how great they are, would be a real kind of confidence boost and a massive kind of like, yeah, you are doing the great work that you like to think you are, Petros. As ever, I have been Petros Patsilivus, your guide through the crazy world of the Coppola family tree. Remember to keep it caged in, and I'll catch you next time.
This podcast is presented by the Breadcrumbs Collective, home of the Pod Charles Cinecast, Caged In Coppola Connections, A Driptown Limerie Main, Franchised, and many more to come. Our shows are all presented ad-free and made possible by listeners like you. Please support our shows by subscribing, leaving ratings and reviews, and becoming patrons at patreon.com. If you'd like to learn more about Breadcrumbs, head over to breadcrumbscollective.com.
Breadcrumbs. It's more than a podcast network. It's family.